What's Underneath is a CastBox original produced in partnership with Studio 71.
CastBox is the fastest growing, highest rated podcast app on both iOS and Android, where you can find all of your favorite podcasts.
You can listen to What's Underneath wherever you get your podcasts, but we hope you'll give CastBox a shot and see for yourself.
Hello and welcome to What's Underneath,
the podcast that will inspire radical self-acceptance through empowering you to embrace what's unrepeatable in you.
I'm Lily Mandelbaum, and sitting next to me is my mom, Elisa Goodkind.
And we are Style Like You. In our new podcast, we are going to expand the types of intimate, unfiltered conversations we've been having in our viral video series, The What's Underneath Project.
Each week, we will interview diverse nonconformists about their relationship to style, self-image, and identity.
Being radically honest without shame and holding that honesty with compassion is self-acceptance.
Okay, hey, Mom.
Hey, Lils.
How you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. I'm finally getting over my head cold. If our listeners didn't notice last week, I was sniffling the whole time. So, Mom, who are we here with today?
We're with Jessie Taylor, who we interviewed for our series, Dispelling Beauty Myths with Allure. It's a series that we did with Allure magazine, and we were so in love with her at the time and regretted how much we had to cut down that interview, which was long and fascinating, to a very sad 5 minutes for us, which is way too short for a Style Like You anything. So we're really, really excited to have her back.
And Jessie, how are you today?
Doing pretty good. Doing pretty good.
I'm sorry, I think in that intro we just messed up your pronouns. You just told us to use they and them.
Oh, no.
No, that's okay. I think we should just talk about it.
Okay.
You weren't identifying with as they and them when we met you, right?
Well, so I've always just not really felt like I fit in with a gender, period. I've always just kind of been like, yeah, I'm a woman, whatever, etc. But there was just always something where it never really actually fit for me, where I never felt like a man or felt anything like that. It was just always not like anything that really exists right now for me to identify with. And I guess when I started to look at gender in the same way that I'd been looking at race, mm-hmm. And really accepting, wow, okay, this is a socially constructed thing that I've really just been accepting as is and going with it and never really questioning it. Mm-hmm. That was when I was like, oh, okay, this is just something else that I have to kind of deconstruct and make sense of in my own way without just fitting myself into some type of box or category that has been given to me or that I've inherited, I guess.
Mm-hmm. When you say woman, like, or as you know of a woman, what in your mind, what is that? Who is that? And what are those characteristics?
It's complicated because I feel like there's this idea of what a woman is that just kind of like floats around in abstraction. And when it really comes down to it, I don't want to say it doesn't mean anything because that's also dismissive of people who strongly identify as a woman or who are wrongly gendered. So I don't even know how to answer that question, to be honest. But I feel like part of my problem was that I thought that there was just like a certain way I was supposed to act or dress or be that a woman is. It's similar to how I think about race, though, where it's like we have these ideas of what it, quote unquote, means to be white or means to be black or means to be this. But when it really comes down to it, it's another construct that is being perpetuated in all these different ways. And we just kind of go with the flow. And then we really stop and think about it. We're like, oh, wait, what is it that I'm calling myself? And letting people identify me as? Do I even actually know what that means?
Is what you're saying, I guess, that to be a whole person, you've realized that you have to remove yourself from these ideas, you know, that have words attached to them and have visuals attached to them. Is that what you mean? Like, in order to really just discover yourself?
Yeah, in a way, yes. And if I do kind of go back to using, like more common labels, like we're saying, it's usually serve some type of purpose or function, or like because of different inequalities and such. I feel like in some spaces it's almost necessary to reclaim some of those labels. I guess the best example would be with regard to race, because like when it really comes down to it, it's like, do I really want to identify as any race? No. Like, I'd rather just not care about that. But then in some cases, it's like, okay, because of systemic oppression and institutional racism, it is important to insert myself as a Black person in certain spaces, because that's important. But then really thinking about it, it's like, okay, but I know me personally, like outside of the world, just in my own self, I'm not actually any of these things, essentially.
And so I'd really love to know, like, where I'm truly, truly fascinated, where, when and where do you feel, because I think this is a huge thing right now. And it's a big step in evolution. Because I think the realizing that you're really not any of those things is sort of the thing that's going to bring us all together.
Yes.
I was just saying, it's like interesting, because at the same time, like more than ever, it's like, I feel like more than ever, people are like claiming the identities that they are, because it's mm-hmm. like being talked about for the first time, like the different yeah. marginalization and oppression mm-hmm. is being talked about in a more, like it's being given more light. And I feel exactly. like it's really important to like own the fact that there are like different experiences mm-hmm. for different groups of people. But at the same time, it's really cool to me that you're also simultaneously acknowledging that kind of underneath it, there's like none of those things are even who you are at your core. And that's, I think, if the culture could master that balance, that would be, we would be evolving to a good place. If we could like master the balance of like both acknowledging mm-hmm. like all of our differences mm-hmm. and like our groupings and the things and our identity groupings that we fall into and like how that affects the world that we're living in, mm-hmm. but also recognize that we're all the same and like none of it. And at the same time, kind of, I think that would be, that feels like it would be a cool progress.
No, I completely agree. I feel like it's giving it language without giving it so much power that we're controlling ourselves and other people or mm-hmm. something like that.
And also yeah. Othering and not yeah. feeling like we're not really connected to other people, mm-hmm. which is, and I've said this already in truth. The podcast, but I've probably said it 10 million. I mean, it's a huge thing that's on my mind. It's just that the identity politics is a very scary thing for liberal thinking people and progressive thinking people mm-hmm. because we're leaving the door wide open for totalitarian society and dictatorship and you know, the people that we really don't want to be in charge because we're not together yeah. and relating to each other. That's one thing. The other thing is, I think it's just basically true that underneath it all, and it's something that we've discovered through the diverse amount of people that we've interviewed over almost a decade, is that everyone's story is everyone's story. Mm-hmm. And that when you really acknowledge your own pain, you can really understand the pain of someone else, and that we don't, you know, no one has sort of a superior market over, agreed. Over pain. And I think that's what really separates us, is, you know, what can really bring us together is uniting on that pain and turning that pain into beauty and turning that pain into self-acceptance and turning mm-hmm. that pain into a coming together, which would then really create the world that we all want to live in.
Yes.
So you're hitting on something, of course, it's not an accident because we felt so connected to you always from the beginning. That really matters a lot to us. So going back, I would love to understand personally, and help the viewers to understand, listeners to understand, when do you feel that it's important for you to identify with being Black, and like why? And when do you not? Because I think that's, you know, it's the step we're all taking.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I guess I feel like only because of the way things are, I feel like it's always necessary, but only because we live in a society that is so stuck in just toxicity and inequality and perpetuated cultures of domination. Like in an ideal world, when things like that don't exist, and we do just live in a way that you were just describing, where we're acknowledging our difference, but in a way that brings us closer. Like if things were like that, then it wouldn't be necessary, because it would just be me, a part of a group of other people. We're not all the same, but we accept that, embrace that, move on, and live together in a way that's respectful. But just since it's not like that, it's just important to, I feel, because it's important for people to see there are Black people taking up space. There are Black people doing this, doing that. And especially when it's things that people have kind of been conditioned to believe don't happen or shouldn't happen, I guess. So it's really just, it's contingent on living in unequal and equityless society.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I totally get that, that you have to maintain a certain position of identity in order to undo the conditioning and the ignorance.
My husband and I, we are intending to do gender creative parenting, which is just from birth, you don't assign them a gender, the child. And it's been really fascinating interacting with my friends, particularly other friends that are pregnant, but just people in general, because one of the first things people will always ask me when they find out is, what are you having? And it's just
when they find out
that I'm pregnant, the first thing they'll always ask is, okay, what are you having? Or are you having a girl or a boy? And I have to say, oh, I don't know yet. And then they'll say, oh, it's too soon to like find out at the OB. And it's like, no, it's not too soon. They just can't tell me their gender yet. So I'm not going to tell them their gender for them. And that's when I get the looks and the stares. And it's just really fascinating to really have conversations now where you really start to see like, wow, people are really trying to already build an entire narrative about this being that hasn't even been born yet's life just because of what their genitals look like. Like I was recently at a baby shower of one of my best friends. Love her, love her, love her. I'm going to love her child so much. But it was just really interesting hearing some of the conversations. It was a lot of pink, a lot of she's going to be a princess. She's going to be a this. I wonder when she's going to find a husband. And it was just things like that where I was like, they're just coming up with all of these things that this person is going to be when we don't know them yet. We haven't even met them. We have no idea who they are, but we have this whole idea planned out in our head already about what they're going to be like, who they're going to love, what their personality traits are going to be like just because of what their genitals look like.
I'm kind of surprised to hear that from your age group. How old are you? How old
I'll be 28 in 2 weeks.
Because I, at 60, have already made that humongous mistake with my gay son. And that was what our third podcast was about. but that was, 30 years ago. And it's in terms of being a mother, I've already spoken about that. It is my biggest regret. And he had to go through so much suffering because of that. Oh, if I could do it all over again and just leave the door wide open, I'd give anything to do that.
Like, I feel like it makes sense. There was, I met this, I don't know if you read an article recently that came out. It's called something with the word they be in it. And it's this couple who are raising their child, gender creative. And
that's such a fun way of putting it.
Gender creative. Yeah. They got so much backlash. So I added them on Instagram and now we're actually in contact and we're going to be like writing an article together, like bringing race into the equation. But, the things people will comment about it, even the people that follow them on Instagram and like will comment on things, like somebody commented on one of my comments on their post and they were like, I don't understand how you could support something like this. This is why children grow up and hate themselves. This is why children grow up and are confused about who they are. Why are we spreading this backwards, twisted, hateful way of raising children? And it's just like, really?
Because, well, I mean, it's the opposite.
Right?
The opposite has created, you know, as we said, we had Lewis's interview in the third episode, and it'll be episode 5. We did Alok Vaid Menon, who's a trans femme, identifies as trans femme, who both Alok and Lewis said basically the identical things of having to grow up hiding from themselves. They couldn't, their whole life was childhood was about a covering up who they were. Mm-hmm. And it was
not getting found out.
And not getting found out. So how anyone could think that this is a good thing, for a human brain, you know, the only good thing I can see about it, but I mean, there's no reason, it's ridiculous. It's only that these two have both taken it and turned it into into activism, mm-hmm. and into something that's defined their lives in terms of a purpose and a larger calling.
Yes.
But at some point, you want to break that chain and then create new things that you can push against.
Exactly.
And just keep evolving.
Mm-hmm. I've been actually thinking a lot more about that, where it's like there are so many people who are driven to be activists or just like really vocal on certain issues because they've experienced so much pain and suffering. And it gets to a point where it's like, yeah, that is awesome, because now there are people that are going to be able to hear these stories and learn about it. But then at the same time, it's like how long do we have to let pain be a main gateway to empowerment almost?
Mm-hmm. Even though, like, obviously we've seen through our interviews that like pain and most of the people that we've interviewed, their pain has caused them, that has created a lot of beauty.
Exactly.
And they've transformed it. But we still, you know, the question is, would you want to inflict the pain?
Exactly.
You know,
to love ourselves and to bring love to the world. That's mm-hmm. our purpose. So our purpose is to stop inflicting pain.
Yes.
On ourselves and on others.
Can you just talk about how you're feeling like right now today in general? Cause like, okay, you just told us you're pregnant. You just graduated from, what was it? Grad school? Yes. Or
no. Just many, many extra years of undergrad.
Extra years of undergrad.
Yeah.
So it's like, it seems like it must be a big moment in your life today. How do you feel?
I feel so thankful that I can just read for fun again. Like, reading is always fun, but I guess it's reading things that aren't assigned to me. Mm-hmm. Like, the first thing I did was go back to one of my favorite Aristotle books, and I was like, all right, I can read this for fun, and I can annotate it if I want, but I don't have any looming deadlines. I don't have any weird guilt because there's something else I feel like I should be doing or should be reading. And it's kind of just like a check in the box.
What did you major in?
So my individualized degree was in philosophy of structural violence. And I'm so thankful that I got to do the individualized degree, because I did get to completely design my own curriculum. When I first started like figuring out what I was going to do for my, like my main focus or whatever, like my main research focus, the first thing I told one of my advisors was that I wanted to write about Black people. And this was in a philosophy department. And I love my advisor. He's an incredible, incredible philosopher, person, human, etc. But one of the first things he said was, this isn't what you do. Like, you want to be an academic philosopher, we're going to have to change it up a little bit. Like, you're going to have to write about something else. And there's a lot of stuff like that. And I
who were you writing about? Who did you want to write about?
From the get-go, I really wanted to, my first ever project I wanted to do was about like rap lyrics and existentialism. And it's funny because like now there's actually like a lot of people are writing about this now. And I'm actually one of my favorite philosophers. He's at Harvard, Tommy Shelby. He's doing so much work on philosophy and hip hop now. And it's cool. Like, it's still not really where I see myself going now. But it's cool that people are doing that. But even when I met him, he was just like, there are going to be so many people who are going to look at my work and say, this isn't philosophy. This isn't what we should be writing about. This isn't what we should be focusing on. And it's because people aren't necessarily citing Hume or citing Kant or citing Kierkegaard, and they're bringing in hip hop lyrics instead or something like that. But I'm, like, my mind is all jumbled because, like, literally yesterday at like 9 p.m. is when I submitted my last paper, and it took so long to write. And I remember talking to one of my advisors about how part of the reason it was so difficult to actually get it done was because it was just taking so much emotional labor. Like, my, it ended, I ended up actually going back and actually writing about Black people. And I wrote about women and their unborn children that are abused or killed by police. And it was just hard to write. And, like, over the course of my research, I ended up, like, I started teaching at Rikers Island in the women's jail. And it was when I did that that I was just like, I don't want to write about this anymore. Like, what am I doing? Like, what am I doing sitting up here writing about this? And I have so much respect for people that do find a way to balance, like, academia and activism. And that's awesome that you can do that. But it got to the point where I was just like, I'm not spending my time writing all these pages when I could actually be out in the world volunteering or babysitting somebody's kid or raising money for some organization or something like that. And that was when it really hit me, where I was just like, I just can't do this anymore.
Did you end up finishing your paper? Because I mean, you finished something last night.
Yeah.
Was that related to Rikers and what you were doing, and or
not separate? Not totally related to what I did. All right. So basically what the thesis ended up being was just about how that there are some women who give birth in prisons or jails, and because of negligence at the hands of the jail staff, they lose their children. And when people bring cases against the jail staff and the medical staff, the cases are almost always tossed out because they have quote unquote qualified immunity. And
what does that mean?
Basically, you just can't hold them accountable for what they did.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just the end of that. And this happens so often.
Wow.
So often.
Oh.
And like, part of the reason I wanted to focus on pregnant people in jails and prisons was because, like, mass incarceration is something, like, everybody's learning about, everybody's talking about, but I don't think a lot of people really realize, like, there are pregnant people in prison that are being abused and that are, like, their kids are dying and nothing is being done about it. And, like, just writing about it, it was just so much to write about. And
once you started opening up the door, it's so huge and so emotionally exhausting. That's what it sounds like.
That's
life changing.
It was just a lot. And I remember at first my goal was to, like, take the project that I was working on and then apply to grad school and, like, expand on that in a philosophy department. But I just, if I were to do something like that, that would be such a long time from now. Like, I'd much rather do, like, creative writing if I'm going to write at all and get the stories out in other ways without having to write in the way that they want to in order for them to even give it a second look. Yeah.
Okay. And so, and how are you feeling now with also being pregnant? Like, it was, and what's this journey been like for you so far?
Unlike what I thought it would be.
It is unlike what you thought it would be?
Completely.
In what way?
So I was training to be a doula, and that was my whole thing for a while. My research actually led me to do that. Like, I want to be a doula in jails and prisons. But so I was learning a lot about childbirth and pregnancy, and while I was learning a lot of really important, necessary things that I didn't know about, I'd also kind of, I guess, romanticized the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
And like, I had this idea of what it would be like when I was to ever get pregnant. And I guess the first thing, so I will tell you this, this is one of the first days that I've been outside for an extended period of time for, like, a really long time.
Because you've been just working on papers, like in a...
Not even. So I actually had to withdraw from most of my classes this semester because of medical reasons. Right. I technically have like a high risk pregnancy, mm-hmm. and it's been really difficult. For a solid like month and a half, I literally couldn't get out of bed. Like my husband had to carry me to the bathroom, and he still actually has to like bathe me.
How many months pregnant are you?
Almost four.
Okay.
Why?
So what I've been going, so I have one, I have like this rare blood disorder, but that's a whole other thing that mostly just impacts like my anemia. So it's just that. But the main thing was I was dealing with this condition that's just causes you to not be able to eat or keep food down or water down. And I ended up being dehydrated, passed out, went to the ER, and I had to be put on really intense medication. And taking the medication was the only way that I could sit up in bed, like, period. There were some days, like, all I did was cry and vomit, just repeatedly, over and over again. And that was for a couple of months. I'd, like, never felt that kind of pain before. I couldn't really walk. Like they have me on medication, they give chemo patients just so that I can like eat food.
And that's okay for the baby?
It's okay for the baby. But it was like, I really wasn't doing anything. I wasn't doing anything. I couldn't even read. And that was when I realized something was really wrong. Like I couldn't open a book. I couldn't do anything. I had never, it was just so much. Like I literally would not have survived if not for my husband. He did everything. So in the last time we spoke, like I talked briefly about bulimia, and this is going to sound so silly, but like there's this weird like irony to it. Cause when I was like, when I first started recovery, I became
from bulimia.
Yeah. I was like terrified of vomiting, terrified of it. Mm-hmm. Like it was just this thing where it was just like, that is not something I do now. And it was just really interesting mm-hmm. that, of course, I'm vomiting like 15, 20 times a day against my will and wishing I could eat. It was just like this weird, weird thing.
I'm so sorry to hear that. And the intensity of just the psychological intensity of the bulimia and then that coming back to you as the thing that you have to like cope with. Oh my gosh, yeah. To have the baby.
Exactly. There's always something that's taken me out of control of my body. Something, whether it's my skin or something. It's always something.
What, can you talk about that a little bit more? Can you talk about the vitiligo a little bit? Just so everybody...
Oh, yeah.
When you say that, like what... Just so everyone understands the context of that.
So yeah, when I was 15, I was diagnosed with vitiligo, which is basically just a skin disorder where the cells that make your pigment die. That, yeah, it was basically just like, okay, I'm going to wake up tomorrow and I'll be more white. Every day, I don't know what my body will look like. So there's just always been this weird, like, not getting too comfortable with what I look like because I know something's going to change. I don't know what it is, but something's going to change. And then for years, because of bulimia, it was, well, my size and thinking about that. And now I just feel differently about my body growing, I guess.
Do you feel like the bulimia was like related to like an effort to an effort to gain control when you were feeling such a loss of control with the vitiligo and with your skin changing? Like,
definitely.
It was like, I can control this one thing about my body. I can just control its size.
That's so literally exactly what I think it was. Mm-hmm.
So you were 15 when your vitiligo started happening. And when did the bulimia start?
At first, it was kind of just like, okay, I need to make sure that I'm like in tip-top shape. Mm-hmm. And that was when I started like quote-unquote dieting. Mm-hmm. And I remember there was this, like I will never forget this day. It was the first time I'd ever like made a goal to lose weight, and then I met the weight. And I remember like I was talking to my mom and she was just like, wow, okay, you're finally starting to take care of yourself. And something clicked in my head and I was just like, oh my God, is this the way to like I'm like, is this what I'm supposed to do? Is this all it takes to like be, I don't know,
acceptable,
exactly, acceptable or respected or like loved or something like that? Is this all that I have to do? And so that's when I started to just like get in the habit of that. Nothing like too serious. But it was really when the vitiligo started that it was kind of like, oh, okay, it's time to turn this into something else. And just like, I look back on those years and I don't even recognize myself because I can't see myself doing any of those things. Like I think about it sometimes and it just doesn't make sense to me. It feels like a completely different person. Like a not me, like an mm-hmm. actual different self.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So what was it like on a day-to-day basis? Like, can you get us in your, like, into your head at that time? I mean, I know it must feel like a long time ago, but.
Yeah, it was just.
Like every meal, would you throw it up or?
So it wasn't every meal. It was more like I would eat like regular meals with people
mm-hmm.
as if everything was okay. But I would like steal money and I would steal food from stores and mm-hmm. I would binge on it.
Mm-hmm.
And then I would purge that multiple times a day. Like I would find time throughout the day to make sure I could do it multiple times a day.
And would you like sit in like a private place and like eat it? Or what was it? Was it like a lot of food or was it just like a Twinkie bar?
I don't know. No, it was pounds of food. Like mm-hmm. it was ridiculous amounts of food.
Mm-hmm.
Like, can you give us an example?
Like, you know those like variety packs of like candy bars?
Mm-hmm.
Like a box of that
mm-hmm.
and then also chips.
Mm-hmm.
Like stuff like that. Or like multiple boxes of Little Debbie things. Like 15 fancy cakes or something. Mm-hmm. Like I can't eat fancy cakes now just because the association in my head is just like eating 20 fancy cakes. And it was so much because I would just go into Publix and just like load up my purse.
That's a grocery store, right?
Yeah.
Where are you from again?
Well, so this is happening in Florida, but I'm from Michigan. I don't even know how I got away with it for so long.
Why were you in Florida even though you're from Michigan?
Oh, so we moved to Florida when my mom got married to my sister's father.
So like your stepfather.
How old was that?
That was when I was about 8. Yeah.
And why do you think you would, why did you choose to eat normal meals and that was okay, but then go and binge? Like what do you think?
Oh, I didn't want anybody to find out.
Huh?
I didn't want anybody to find out.
Right.
It was just that simple. As long as I was sitting down with everybody.
They wouldn't know.
It was what it was.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
but would your weight fluctuate or?
No, that was like the main reason I was able to last for so long. My weight never fluctuated because I was also addicted to laxatives and diuretics. So it's like, yeah, I was like eating like the meals and stuff. But like when it really came down to it, it wasn't really like staying anywhere. So I was always like right in the same weight range. And I was really athletic then still. So like you would have never thought anything unless I told you.
And how did that end?
And also, where would you eat the food just to make sure? I think it's important to just like paint a picture. Like,
yeah.
Would you eat the food privately, like in your bedroom? Or like, where would you take this food that you had gotten?
Well, when I would binge, it would have to be by myself.
Right.
That's what I mean. Sometimes it would be like outside behind this tree in my neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
It was actually usually by that tree in my neighborhood. And then I would just like bring bags with me to like throw up into and then throw away. But sometimes just like in my bedroom, if mm-hmm. nobody else is home, or take a shower, quote unquote,
mm-hmm.
but just like do it in there.
Mm-hmm.
So mostly that. And I'd say it was like 3 to 5 times a day for a good like 4 or 5 years.
Wow.
Wrecked my teeth. But then it was, I'd say, right around the time I moved to New York was when I started to like realize that I had a problem. But it was because I'd like gotten really close to one of my friends and it was like talking to her where I was like, maybe I should get therapy. But not for that. Like it was for like other reasons where I was like, maybe I should see a therapist, and it was in seeing a therapist for other things that the other stuff started to come out too. Yeah.
And what was it at the end of the day, were you trying to control emotions? Like, what, can you talk a little bit about what that discovery was of what you were trying to do?
It really just comes down to just like the control aspect. I feel like there were so many different things that happened in my life that I like buried down and tried to ignore or pretend didn't happen. And I
like
would,
what?
Just like abuse or...
If you're enjoying what you're hearing, please subscribe.
Emotional abuse.
And give us a good rating. Both. So the powers that past be trauma. Keep this podcast
and
going.
It was really just a way for me to, I don't know, like take ownership, I guess, of my body. And yeah, it was just taking ownership.
And nobody found out?
No, not that I didn't explicitly tell. I feel like my mom definitely like had an idea, but she's got some things that she's got to work out on her own. So I think even if she did know, it's not something she would have actually tried to like sit with and help me with. Because I think in her own way, she was like dealing with similar things. So she probably really would have just saw what I was doing as like a good thing.
Can you talk a little bit more about those 4 or 5 years that you were struggling with this eating disorder, but also your skin was changing and how that was like feeling on a day-to-day basis for you? And
So during those years, that was when I was like addicted to makeup,
mm-hmm.
Like addicted to covering the vitiligo. Mm-hmm.
And it started on your face, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I also had just like a whole different, like, I don't even, like, it's just weird thing because it's so not me, but it was like this whole like thing I had going on where it was like my makeup was perfect. I always wanted my hair to look a certain way and I carried myself in this very certain way.
What was your hair like?
Then it was just like straight. And then eventually I did like a layered with bangs thing. Just all the makeup, all the hair stuff, just like a lot of hiding behind a lot of stuff. But then in the behind the scenes, I was just like wanting to die.
Can you talk a little bit about the identity issues of your skin turning white and you're trying to preserve your blackness?
Yeah. So at that particular time in my life, I wasn't really thinking about race so much. I was actually like bullied a lot in middle and high school for quote unquote trying to be white or acting white and talking white.
Even before the vitiligo.
This is before the vitiligo. So like the jokes actually got like really terrible. There was one dude when I was in 11th grade who was like, wow, you wanted to be white so bad that God decided to help you out. And I remember hearing
that.
Was
he black or white?
He was white. I cared so much about what people thought. Like so much. So much. And I think, yeah, honestly, if I could go back, I would educate them on the fact that race is a social construct, tell them what vitiligo is, and then just not care anymore. Because I would just internalize everything. And I would like let what people say impact how I was seeing myself instead of just like letting it roll off and realizing that what they said didn't matter. Like I would really like take it to heart. And at that point, I was definitely dealing with a lot of internalized racism where it was like, as long as I do these things, like get these grades, read these books, wear these clothes, listen to this music, then I'm not.
What kind of music?
I guess the music one might be a weird example to bring in. I don't know. Because at that point, I guess I was just listening to a lot of like emo music, but like, I don't even...
Clothes? What kind of clothes?
So I went through a stage where... What did I say? I don't know what I would call it, but like when I was really athletic, I was skateboarding a lot. And that was my look for a while. But then when I got to 10th grade, my mom was just like, I'm exclusively buying you clothes from The Limited now. And so I just wore clothes from The Limited and New York and Company like for the rest of my high school career. And that was fun.
And the makeup. Unlimited.
Yeah. So it was like
this idea of like the fashionable.
But so girl. You didn't want to be associated with like things that seemed
stereotypically black. Yeah.
Like hip hop or rap or.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And I just distanced myself. And it was interesting because for a lot of those years, before vitiligo, so right before vitiligo happened was when I was still living with my mom, my sister, and my sister's father. Now, my sister's father is this like light-haired, blue-eyed, racist, militant man. And then my sister, like half black, half white. And so it was like this multicultural family. But like, for all intents and purposes, I was like living in an Eastern European household. And like for a while, I even went to Latvian school. And her dad would almost exclusively speak Latvian and Russian around the house. And like I became like super obsessed with that culture for a while too. And I just never like learning about like blackness just like wasn't a thing. I feel like it was until we moved to Florida because my grandparents were like big on like teaching me things like that. But then I kind of got like...
Your mother's parents.
My mom, yeah. Then I guess I quite literally got like beaten out of me, but like,
what do you mean?
Well, he was just like really abusive.
Who? The stepfather.
Stepfather. Yeah.
The white man.
Yeah.
And your mother knew about that?
Was she being abused?
To this day, I don't know, but I have a feeling she was. I would be shocked if she wasn't. Mm-hmm. Yeah. He's literally a terrible person. Like, I don't hate people, but if I were to hate a person, I hate him.
Why don't you hate people?
I just feel like everybody's redeemable. I don't know. There's something different about him that I don't even know how to explain, but very racist, very violent, needs help.
How did he deal with the vitiligo?
Oh, at that point, we weren't in each other's lives anymore because about a year and a half before that, he told me that I wasn't allowed to come to his house anymore because at that point, they'd like separated and only my sister was allowed to be a part of his family at that point, not me anymore.
Wow.
Yeah.
So that's a lot that you were dealing with as a teenager.
You've had to constantly deal with
no control.
Yeah, with your body surprising you. I forget what you said, but you said it really beautifully. Like just this constant surprise from your body.
Yeah.
How have you learned how to deal with that? Like what? Because at the end of the day, our body, this is something that Lily's therapist turned her on to this spiritual speaker who has resonated a lot with me that just talks about how it's our bodies that are evolving. Like our mm-hmm. bodies are
in this path. Or like running the show.
Yeah. And our bodies are in this path. Like we're already whole spirits.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We're already whole.
Truth.
It's through our bodies that we come to understand that wholeness. Mm-hmm. And it's our body that's learning the lesson.
Yes.
We're learning lessons through our bodies. So when you said that, it made me, and personally, I'm going through some, you know, I've been through that. I have a very sensitive body that goes through a lot of things. It's very difficult to deal with. And it's a struggle to accept that.
Mm-hmm.
How do you deal with that? And how do you accept that? And what have you learned and how have you coped?
I think really realizing that like, who I am is not my body as much as I thought it was really helped where it's like, it's going to change. Like it is going to change. I don't know what it's going to look like tomorrow. I don't know what it's going to look like in a couple months from now. I don't want to say it's just this thing, but like it kind of is. It's kind of just this thing that's carrying me around. That I kind of have to make other people comfortable about in some way. And like, I feel like there's all these places and spaces that I'm never going to feel comfortable in or accepted in. I should at the very least like feel a little comfortable in like this one, I guess.
I feel like you have taken a lot of steps to not make other people necessarily feel comfortable with
not wearing makeup.
Yeah. I mean, I'll never forget the story of when you, the day you
went to the restaurant.
Yeah. Oh, at work. Oh my gosh.
Without makeup.
Yeah.
But
it's, I guess, supposed to make people feel comfortable.
But it's supposed to, yeah. But that's not what you choose, yeah, to like do.
No, not anymore. I don't care. You're gonna get what you get, mm-hmm, kind of thing. But that's a drastic difference from what I used to think and what I think people want us to think, where it's like, how can you make sure that you are only taking up the space that they want you to and in the way that they want you to, in order for them to accept you or for them to acknowledge you or to respect you? That's how I used to think. And I feel like that's how
you would find a way to figure out,
how can I make everybody else more comfortable right now? Instead of, why do I care about these people's feelings that I'm probably never going to see again?
So on a daily basis, like when you go outside, you don't wear any makeup, obviously, anymore. Do you feel like you have to prepare yourself like for a day of bullshit? Or do you feel so kind of in your own like world and comfortable that
whenever I get ready to go out or do anything, I just throw stuff on.
Which is really different.
It's so different
than how you used to be.
Yeah.
The reaction. So can you like walk us through like a day in the life of like the types of reactions you get, or do people come up to you? Do they talk to you?
It depends what I'm wearing. If I didn't have these socks on, I would probably...
Will you explain what you're wearing to people that can't see?
So I have on black thigh-high socks and then a black dress that goes about to where the thigh-high socks end. If I didn't have the socks on, I'd probably get a lot more stares because my legs are super hairy and they're two colors. So like, I know for a fact if I was not wearing socks, I would have definitely gotten more stares. So it's like, it really does just depend like how much skin I'm showing, I guess. Mm-hmm. And now it's a whole thing where like on the train, I think people are trying to figure out like, especially like if my stomach is extra big that day, I get a lot more looks now where people are like trying to figure out like what's going on. Or like if I don't have a wig on and I'm bald that day, I feel like people are always trying to like figure me out or something, figure out what's going on. And some days I'll
just... So now you've got like two things, because you've got vitiligo, which is, they're always trying to figure out, and then you're pregnant, so they're also trying to figure that out.
And then all the hair.
Meaning that you're wearing a wig right now, a pink...
All the wig, but then also like, say I'm wearing a tank, like the armpits.
Oh, right, the hair.
Or like body, the leg. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's a thing that I definitely makes people uncomfortable, which is really
right. So it's all weird. Very challenging to their own sense of self.
Because they're trying to figure out what I am, I guess, so that they can figure out how they're going to treat me, or
so that they can figure out who they are.
Whew, yeah, yeah, very
just
true.
More like it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because you're sitting there, the like in the most in your face way possible between all of those various factors,
mm-hmm,
saying I'm good.
Yeah.
You're not walking around in a hooded sweatshirt. You know, you're not walking, yeah, around undercover.
Yeah. That definitely used to be me, very undercover.
Because this is you and you're just presenting yourself as you. And mm-hmm, for a lot of people, the majority of people, just being you is, they don't feel as okay within them, their own selves.
Mm-hmm.
Can you just talk a little bit about like some of the moments or the people or what, like the things that inspired you to stop hiding and to, you know, make that transition between making other people comfortable as opposed to making yourself comfortable?
I don't know. This might sound weird, but sometimes when I just see other people just like out in the world, just like smiling about something, it's just like Okay. All right. Like, that's, I know that probably sounds like so minor.
You mean like you would see those people and feel inspired by their like,
yeah, just random
carefree
people.
Like joy.
Yeah, just people I don't even know mm-hmm. that just look okay. Like they look okay in themselves. Mm-hmm. And they like you know when you can just like mm-hmm. look at somebody mm-hmm. and you can tell like, wow, they are here for them. And whenever I see people like that, it's just like, wow. Yes. Thank you. Like, yes, please. Yes. But I guess another like a person like I can give one of my friends. She's like the recent cover girl with Vitiligo. When I first met her and started like getting to know her and how she would embrace Vitiligo, I was just kind of like, wow. And I thought I was confident. Like she
so this
really
is like recently.
This is a couple of years ago that I met her.
So like post like stopping wearing makeup.
Yeah, and post stopping wearing makeup. It was really seeing her just be so confident and just living her life, doing her thing. Even so after we did the Style Like You video, when I would get messages from people. Those were really intense, really, really intense.
What kind of messages?
Just a lot of like, you helped me feel more comfortable, or you made me realize that I should stop caring what people think. And it was just like reading like literally hundreds and hundreds of messages like that, where I was just like, oh my gosh, like, whoa, okay. And then it was really like, okay, I should really like, really start to really, really, really embrace this and just not care so much, because like, there are other people that are probably dealing with what I've dealt with. And if it gives them a little sense of something, then that's so amazing. Like if just me being outside smiling makes somebody else feel like they can be a little bit more confident, like, that's so huge. That's crazy.
Each accomplishment, each achievement, each person mm-hmm. is so, so, so valuable.
Each person.
To your own life mm-hmm. that you've touched them. It's just, it's enough.
It really is. I remember that one of the first ones I read ever was this mother who was like, I'm so glad I saw this so I could show it to my daughter. She is 8 and she's trying to figure out how to like deal with getting made fun of at her school. And I'm going to show her this.
Did she have vitiligo?
Her daughter did. Mm-hmm. And then she came back and commented again. And she was like, I showed this to my daughter and she's a completely new person now. And I was just like, oh my God. So if I would have saw that when I was really little, that would have been amazing. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do you feel that vitiligo, the bulimia, the various things that you've gone through, deep, deep struggles that you've gone through in terms of your body, what has it given you?
I guess just a really interesting perspective. Like it really just forced me to question everything.
When you say like it's made you question everything and you have this like interesting perspective that's really different than most people because you don't really fit into, you know, your body has like forced you to be like outside of a norm in a box, like It kind of comes full circle to me to like what we were talking about earlier with now you're questioning gender and now you're questioning race in all these ways. Like you, it's made you this, I mean, it seems to me like it's made you this very like questioning and a person with a very like expansive perspectives on issues that maybe other people wouldn't have been forced to think about.
You said it very humbly that it's changed your perspective, but I think that's a humble way of saying it. I think it's actually sort of blown the limiting perspective, the way that life can be very confining and limiting without these challenges. It's kind of blown you out of the, you know, blown the world apart and blown all of these systems and all of these kind of lies apart. Yeah. And it's not enabled you to really live in a lie. Yeah. It's pushed you to live your truth. What's your biggest source of shame?
I guess being more patient with my friends than I am with my family.
You don't feel very patient with your family.
Oh, I'm not patient
with
them at all.
And you feel ashamed about that because you don't feel like it's necessarily like reflective of like your...
I just don't think it's fair. Like how earlier I said, I think everybody's redeemable. And like I take a lot of care to not just understand my friends, but also like make sure that I'm extremely communicative and hold myself accountable for things when it comes to disagreements. And just like go, I really take my friendship seriously. Even if that means sometimes being like, honestly, I can't communicate for a couple of months right now because I'm doing this. Like, we're going to have to like pause for a while because I can't give you what you need right now. Like stuff like that. But sometimes I won't talk to family members for like months and months at a time, but I just won't say anything, I guess.
Why is that?
I think it eventually something just happened where I just felt like I didn't have to. I didn't need to. And maybe there are certain things from the past that I was just like, because you accepted this, why should I take time to try and repair our relationship? Like, why should I do that? Yeah. And I guess that does fill me with shame. I've never thought about it before.
That's a really interesting answer and a really, I think, probably a lot of poignant one. I think a lot of people could probably relate to that. Does it go back? Does it connect back to, do you feel, to forgiveness? And are certain acts actually forgivable?
Right.
And do you have to?
And do you have to? Exactly. Like, it's so
because
much.
Like, even if your body and your soul and your spirit and everything about you doesn't just feel like it, like, what are you gonna do about that? Like, it's, you mm-hmm. know, do you have to? Do you have to feel guilty and shameful about that? I think that's a big question.
What does self-acceptance mean to you?
Just being okay with who you are that day, because you might not be the same the next day. Like, do you ever feel like every day you're a different person? It's kind of like that, where it's like, I wouldn't say self-acceptance is just like accepting who you are, because I could change. Like, you might be, I don't know who I'll be next month. I don't know. Like, I don't know how I'll change when I give birth.
You have like what you've experienced with vitiligo and the lack of control over like your body changing so frequently and constantly. It's like you really have a leg up on the aging process. Like, because you've let go of control of like the inevitable fact that your body is going to mm-hmm. and perpetually be in a state of changing. I'm like, damn you! That's gonna be a whole thing that I don't think I've had to confront or experience yet. What would you say to your 14, 15 year old self, right when vitiligo was starting and when you were struggling with bulimia and all of that? If you could give them any words of wisdom or advice or comfort, what would you say?
Literally everything anybody says to you has everything to do with them and nothing to do with you.
That goes along with people's actions, I think, too, or non-actions.
Mm-hmm. Oof. Oof. Yeah, true.
They're not about you either. Anyway, thank you. This was beautiful, amazing.
Thank you.
Really, really, really great.
I love talking with y'all.
We hope you were inspired by this episode.
Until next week, that's it from me, Elisa.
And me, Lily.
If you agree that facades separate us and being radically honest brings us together, help spread the movement for radical self-acceptance by sharing this episode and subscribing to our podcast.
You can also watch our videos by subscribing to our YouTube channel and following us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook using the handle @StyleIQ.
That's the letter U instead of the word U.
And check out our book, True Style is What's Underneath, The Self-Acceptance Revolution, on Amazon or at a local bookstore near you.
We can't skip ahead to a happy ending or live inside a Photoshopped image or an Instagram filter. There's no finding oneself when glossing over the truth.